And welcome back. The recent For the Sake of All study here in St. Louis showed the impact of health care, or lack of it, in disadvantaged communities and how it can have a sweeping negative impact on life and death, especially when compared to more affluent communities. An event is being held in St. Louis next week to discuss the issues of health disparities and the practice of precision medicine. So, what is precision medicine, and how might it affect disparities in health care? With me in studio, Dr. Will Ross, the Associate Dean and Director of the Office of Diversity Programs at Washington University School of Medicine, and Professor Sarah Gellert is the E. Desmond Lee Professor of Racial and Ethnic Diversity at Washington University's George Warren Brown School of Social Work. Thank you both so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you for inviting
us. It's good to be here.
Sarah, if I can begin with you, what is precision medicine?
Precision medicine is sometimes called personalized medicine, but it's a new way of approaching things, starting with cancer, which is an area in which I work, that would look at a person's genetic makeup and some things about their lifestyle and try to then devise treatments that work for them. And there are two things going on now. There's the Precision Medicine Initiative
that President Obama's, yes.
Right, announced in the State of the Union, which would set the way, which would gather the information to inform this precision or personalized medicine.
Dr. Ross, connect the dots between precision medicine, if you will, and the economic disparities that we're talking about.
Sure. So with regards to precision medicine, there's a new taxonomy that was actually discussed back in 2011 by the National Academies, which made that connection. It's not just individualized medicine, but it's individualized medicine which addresses the central issues that surround our health, social issues, environmental issues, more than just our genetic endowment. It links that type of molecular medicine with broader care that really affects the social determinants of health, those factors that really undergird our health. And so we want to let our audience know that there should not be a dichotomy when we talk about precision medicine and these social determinants. At the onset, there was always been an attempt to keep those linked and to keep the focus on all the components that contribute to our health.
But there is this dichotomy, obviously, between the people that we're talking about and would want to take advantage of what is available to them there and access to it, right, Professor?
Right. You've sort of hit the nail on the head. Something came out this week written by Bayer and Galea in the New England Journal that talked about the fact that faulted precision medicine as it's sort of defined now for focusing too much on the clinic and not enough on this steep social gradient that really characterizes who becomes sick and who dies in the United States. And the way it's set up now, the way it's envisioned, much of the information would come from an electronic health record. And everyone's trying to sort of pare it down to the fewest number of things you could take from the electronic health record. And we're concerned that that doesn't capture the lives of everyone in the United States, especially those who are more marginalized.
Well, your research has shown, research I've seen that you've been involved in, shows that the overwhelming number of people who have been monitored, if that's the right word, have been more affluent white people.
Exactly.
Right.
And if we rely on the electronic medical record, I'm worried, too, that not the people I work with don't all have electronic health records. They might have been seen in many emergency departments, maybe once at City Hospital, maybe once somewhere else. I'm not sure you could capture their lives from the information you get.
Dr. Ross, if in fact there's any record at all, because they might not have been able to go any place for treatment, correct?
That's true. And so what we can do is actually build an infrastructure that to capture this information. And a lot of the large health information firms are doing just that. Building a record which includes those social factors, not just health records, but income, place of employment, where people reside, housing. That's all part of the social history. It's all part of the medical record. And when we interpret one's genes, we realize that those genes don't always dictate how one will function later on in life. I mean, the genes are adaptable. Genes are amenable to environmental influences. And our goal, one of the purported goals of precision medicine, is to evaluate how genes respond to environmental influences. This whole concept that we've been speaking on for many years of epigenetics, and we won't understand how genes are modified by the environment if we don't capture that environmental history in our medical record. And so we're hoping that this precision medicine initiative really becomes much more comprehensive and less detailed and less prescriptive. Otherwise, you won't have this population health lens, and you won't have the impact on the broader society that we need.
I don't know where all of this has been illustrated more dramatically than here in St. Louis as a result of the For the Sake of All report that your colleague, Jason Purnell, has done. I mean, when we talk about a variance of 18 years of life expectancy between two adjacent zip codes, because one is affluent and one is poor, that really makes the case, doesn't it?
It does. And so so on the one hand, you can look at that disparity in life. You can ask, what are the determinants? We know that our health care contributes only to 20% of health. The rest of those factors include our environment, the toxic environment we live in, our behavior, as well as the social and economic factors. And the For Sake of All really highlighted those economic factors. But again, we realize that they don't exist in a vacuum either. They have a way of affecting how we respond to our own genetic endowment. And so if we spend time on research or funding, it has to be proportionate. And if we're to address some of the disparities in this community, there has to be proportionate funding on the clinical genetic component as well as the environmental, the social factors that undergird health.
Will the President's initiative do that, provide the funding and make this happen?
Well, the President's asking for $215 million to enroll 1 million people and follow them through time. There are still being hearings in Washington about how that would happen.
It's $215 a person. That's not very much.
One could say that, yes. And I'm concerned about people participating. They want to do it as quickly as possible, because certainly we want to be able to address some of these questions, these pressing health questions. But I want to make sure that they don't do it entirely by just enrolling clinic populations, people already in care. And because this million-person group, they're not calling it a cohort anymore, needs to be representative, and it needs to include people who are experiencing disparities. I also worry that it costs now, although the costs of genetic testing have gone down markedly, it's still about $1,000 to sequence a genome. Will that limit who is in the cohort?
Well,
and also in terms of when we're ready, when we have precision medicine, will public insurance pay
is this
to
a
have
concern,
some of this testing done?
Concern you have, Doctor?
It's a concern. I have a much broad. I agree with my colleague, Professor Geller, but I have a broader concern. My concern really reaches beyond the immediate amount of funding we spend in the healthcare sector. Let's take the initiative that Professor Geller is alluding to. If we focus this effort on, let's say, patients with cancer, realizing that according to the American Cancer Society fact sheet, over 600,000 people will die a year in cancer. If we could identify those individuals and provide precision medicine, this is at a cost of perhaps $100,000. Dollars per person. So we're talking about a $60 billion expenditure. Now, think of what we could do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a precision medicine scold, okay? I embrace the concept. But again, there has to be a proportionate use of resources.
You've just priced it out of the marketplace. I mean, this is not going to happen.
Well, in reality, you know, we will adjust. We can't spend $3 trillion a year and 18% of our GDP on health. And so, yeah, it will adjust. But while it's adjusting, as Professor Geller was saying, we have to make sure that we're looking at the population that really has the greatest need, and that if we identify a cohort, that cohort has to be inclusive.
And we haven't been that good at recruiting minorities in trials. The 1993 NIH Revitalization Act said that funded research had to include, it had to include minorities. We had to measure them. But 20 years later, only 20% of people are in clinical trials as assessed by a meta-analysis in a major cancer journal were minorities.
Well, where are we now in terms of, I know we're at the early stages of this whole process.
Yeah.
Where are we now in assembling the proper group of people? You don't want to call it a cohort, but the proper group of people so that we can get an accurate picture that will also involve the people who probably need it most.
I think we're just beginning, and programs like this that really let people know about the Precision of Medicine Initiative are important. And I said something wrong earlier. It really is that only 20% of randomized controlled trials on cancer reported in that journal analyze results by race, ethnicity.
So yeah, I agree that we really are at the we're at the inception of this, but we do have a roadmap, and we actually have two roadmaps. The first one was 2005 when we initiated the clinical translational research enterprise for the country, and this was when Elias Zerhouni was director of NIH. And one of the things I recall, Don, is that we should do this for the good of the nation, and this whole focus on clinical translational research was for the good of the nation. Well, the National Academies came out with a report in 2011 saying that precision medicine has to be unveiled and executed in a manner that really is for the good of the nation. It should be holistic in its effort. And it laid out taxonomy, how we identify this, how we label this, and how we execute this. And so we really do have a roadmap. We just now need to find the right way of executing.
But that was 10 years ago. That's we've been on the road now for 10 years. How far along are we?
We're not that far along.
I know.
This is still, I agree, a relatively new initiative, which is why it's really important at this early stage to set some parameters around this for who's involved, who's included, which groups will benefit, which groups need to benefit the most. And in terms of how we benefit society, unless we address those groups that are disadvantaged, that are marginalized, then we won't have the societal impact. And we'll have greater expenditure without really moving the needle in terms of making America healthier.
But, we had sort of this discussion during the debate over Obamacare and what the advantages to that would be. And that not only was a hard sell, there are a lot of people today in Congress in particular and elsewhere who want to do away with it altogether. So it wasn't sold at all to some.
It will be a hard sell, but I think we will have succeeded in this if we have a cohort for the PMI that's representative of the major health disparities in the country, St. Louis and elsewhere.
It's Precision Medicine Initiative, the PMI. There's,
yes, exactly.
Just so we're clear on that.
And if we don't include subpopulations, the ones that are disproportionately affected by these disparities, we really raise the possibility of this failing and not informing precision medicine as we hope it would.
It will be a hard sell if we try to give the American public a sense that we have the answer and then we can't deliver it because we don't really have the answer yet. And we have to be upfront and honest about what this initiative can and cannot do.
Exactly.
Well, how long will it take? I mean, assuming it moves along at some established pace, and we're talking 10 years ago, a moment ago, you mentioned it's been a 10-year process so far in making certain advances. But we're at the early stage now. How long are we talking about?
Well, we're actually moving in terms of the actual generation of products, cancer, let's say cancer products. We're doing well. There are well over 60 new anti-cancer drugs out there that can be used in this effort. But now that we can drill down and do that now, but we need to back off and say, well, that's great. We can spend this effort, this funding now, but let's back off and be more inclusive and address groups that are more likely to have a lower health. So that's going to take some time to back out.
That's what I'm getting at. That's the timetable I'm looking at. How long is it going to take to get this information and get this group together and get what you need to make use of what medical technologies we have?
At the hearings in Washington from the Precision Medicine Initiative Working Group, people, many, many time frames were batted around. Mm-hmm. If young people are included, it could take many more years. I don't think that's been determined. But unless we have minority groups included, these treatments that we come up with might not be effective for them. And so it's so incredibly important that we do that.
I agree. We can't answer the question about the time frame, but we do know that if we identify a particular gene which may be relevant in terms of addressing some of the larger issues that impact health, you know, our high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity. If we can identify genes and then create targeted strategies, and then through the process of diffusion of innovation, you know, increasing health literacy of the practitioners and the public, I mean that's an effort that could actually transpire within several years. That's mm-hmm. not a decade long process.
It's true.
But we have to kind of back up and ask, you know, how do we really identify the right scientific methodology to identify the right genes which will have the greatest impact? You know, we can identify a gene that's associated with high blood pressure in African Americans or HIV progression in African Americans, or such a gene has been identified. How do we then decide whether or not we want to scale out, and what are the ethics of scaling up and doing that investigation and coming up with a intervention? That, you know, that takes, you know, a lot of clinical trials and phase 1, 2, and 3 trials. It does take some time.
It is going to take some time, but there has to also be, Professor, I'll put this to you and then to you, Doctor, there also has to be a political component to this, because what you're talking about is an expenditure of money, and we all know what that means in today's political environment.
No, it's true. I think that Dr. Collins, the director of NIH, who's really been promoting this, is doing a good job of trying to get out and talk to advocacy groups, but it's going to take a long time to include. I think it has the potential, though, I'm not sure if you agree, Will, to actually increase trust. If it were done well, it could increase trust.
It can increase trust only if there's a proportionate funding.
Uh-huh.
So you have to realize that, you know, preventive health receives maybe at best 3 to 5% of the funding for health in this country. As the budget for the NIH is somewhere around $31 billion, and the budget for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is around $6.5 billion. So there is a difference there, and if we're going to say that we're going to engage in this initiative and we want to actually have something that will affect the entire population, then there has to be a proportionate spending for the preventive health, the public health part, and we don't have that yet. And that's
how,
a political
issue. That has to be appropriated, and that's where
right,
that's, our political leadership comes in.
Right.
So if we get people in the country to tell their legislators that they think this is a good idea because it has the potential to really help us decrease the rates of disease in the U.S., and decrease disparities, perhaps that will help.
The word came up a couple of moments ago, but do we have any sense at this early stage, if I can call it an early stage, do we have any sense as to what role the insurance companies would play?
Well, you know, I would say a year ago, I wasn't sure that insurance companies would take up the gauntlet and pay for some of these really expensive medications. But with greater patient advocacy, they're doing that. And so I think that over time, the cost of some of these products that are generated through precision medicine will fall. There'll be economies of scale. And so insurance companies will indeed take up this cost. But here's the problem. The cost will be shared. And as a consequence, our overall GDP, our overall investment in healthcare will increase. But at what cost?
In a word, Professor, you agree?
Sadly, I do. I wish I didn't.
All right. We're going to have to leave it at that. It's a fascinating subject. And obviously, we're at the very early stage here, and we'll see how it develops. Keep us posted, will you? Both of you being local, thank you. Professor Geller, thank you for being with us. And Dr. Ross, good to see you again.
Thank you.
A reminder of your event, by the way, which is happening next week. The Academy of Science St. Louis presents an evening with the experts, DNA, Personalized Medicine, and You. That's Tuesday, September 1st from 5:30 to 9:30 over at Cortex on Duncan Avenue. Thank you so much for being with us. That's going to do it for us for today. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Dwan Warmack, president of Harris Stowe State University. We'll also take a look at financial literacy for young adults. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.